Glad to be with you tonight after skipping a Saturday, but that's another story altogether. No, I wasn't incarcerated. Maybe on the run, but not incarcerated. All right, our next guest, the author of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. This is some scary, scary stuff. Let me just take a little piece here. Well, it's the story of a childhood and adolescence in the shadow of the Cold War. In a landscape at once startlingly beautiful and unknown to those who live there, tainted with invisible yet deadly particles of plutonium. As Kristen Iverson grew older, she began to ask questions. She learned about the infamous 1969 Mother's Day fire, in which a few scraps of plutonium spontaneously ignited and, despite the desperate efforts of firefighters, came perilously close to a criticality, the deadly blue flash that signals a nuclear chain reaction. I said it before and I'll say it again. You need to think about after, before, meaning, would you rather find out before you pull that trigger or after what the business end was pointed at, so to speak? It's just a metaphor. Yep. I knew you would agree. We'll be right back with Kristen Iverson. This is the Annihilation Negation Conversation on Coast to Coast AM. Kristen Iverson grew up in Arvada, Colorado, near the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weaponry Facility, and received a PhD in English from the University of Denver. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Reader's Digest, Fourth Genre, and many other journals and publications. She is an associate professor at the University of Memphis, where she directs the MFA program in creative writing. During the summers, she serves on the faculty of the MFA Low Residency Program at the University of New Orleans, held in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and Edinburgh, Scotland. She is the author of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats, and Molly Brown, Unraveling the Myth, winner of the Colorado Book Award for Biography and the Barbara Sudler Award for Nonfiction. She's also the author of a textbook, Shadowboxing, Art and Craft in Creative Nonfiction. And we're going to talk to her right now about what was it like growing up around a nuclear weaponry plant known as Rocky Flats. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here. I'm very, very, very happy that you consented to this interview. Your book is really sobering. And I located that map of fault lines located near nuclear plants that Mr. Gunderson and I were discussing earlier. And I'll put it up on the caravantomidnight.com site after a while. But please tell us, why did you write this book, and how long did it take to research and write it?
Well, I wrote this book because it was such an important part of my childhood. Rocky Flats was a huge secret in my neighborhood. We could see the water tower of the plant from our back porch. And many of the parents in the neighborhood, many people in the neighborhood worked at Rocky Flats, but they weren't allowed to talk about their work, and we never really knew what went on out there. When I was a kid, the plant was operated by Dow Chemical, and the rumor in the neighborhood was that they were making household cleaning supplies. In fact, my mother thought they were making scrubbing bubbles, but they weren't making scrubbing bubbles. They were producing plutonium triggers for nuclear weapons. And over the course of almost 40 years, Rocky Flats produced more than 70,000 plutonium triggers for nuclear bombs. And each trigger contains enough breathable particles of plutonium to kill every person on Earth. But we didn't know that. And I was so curious about the plant as I was growing up. And then later, like a lot of kids in my neighborhood, I went to work at Rocky Flats myself. So I wrote the book to find out exactly what happened at Rocky Flats. I wanted to understand how important it was to me, to Colorado, and to the country and the history of the Cold War. And I was also concerned that in Colorado, we are working very hard to forget the story of Rocky Flats, to literally and figuratively cover up the story. So it was really a process of discovery, and it was a process that took 10 years of research and writing. It took 10 years to really get my heart and mind around this book and do all the research that was necessary to tell the whole story.
Well, now, so because Rocky Flats was a nuclear weaponry plant, I take it took a little bit of doing to be able to actually work there.
Well, not necessarily. I think a lot of people began out at Rocky Flats working in the cafeterias or working as janitors. People said it was a great place to work, steady employment, good wages, good benefits. You could work your way up. Many of the people that I talk about in my book started out in the cafeteria or as janitors. And then they eventually were trained in different areas and got a Q clearance or advanced clearance and eventually went to work in the plutonium production areas. I never worked on the production line. I never worked in the plutonium facility. I worked primarily as a technical writer, putting together reports. I worked with different engineers and managers and that sort of thing. But a lot of people worked out at Rocky Flats over the years.
All right, so you didn't go to work there so that you could find out what was going on there. You went to work there because you wanted a job there.
Well, you know, it was a little bit of both. At the time, I was, I guess this is kind of the Silkwood part of the story in a way. I was a single parent with two kids, and I was putting myself through graduate school. And Rocky Flats was considered one of the best jobs in town, although people didn't really understand exactly what was being done out there. And so I needed a job. I didn't fully understand at the time what I was getting into. And yet at the same time, I have to say, I was enormously curious about what it was like to work there, what it felt like and what the experience was like, what it looked like. I was so curious about it because I knew so little about it. But it wasn't really until the day I quit. And I want to tell you about what happened on that particular day. I had been working at Rocky Flats for a while, and I came home from work, picked up my kids, gave them their suppers and put them to bed, and came downstairs and fixed myself a cup of tea and turned on the television. And there was a Nightline episode on television, and they were interviewing many of the people that I worked with at Rocky Flats, including Mark Silverman, who was the Department of Energy manager out there at the time. And to his credit, he was one of the first and only managers to be quite forthcoming about what was going on at the plant and how bad the contamination was on-site and off-site. I learned that I was working next to 14 tons of plutonium, much of it unsafely stored. And I was stunned. And, you know, I thought, how can I grow up next to this plant, work at this plant, and not be fully aware of the risk and of exactly what was going on. So that was the night that I knew that I would quit, and the day that I quit was the day that I knew I would write a book about it.
Roughly how long ago was that when you stopped working there?
I stopped working in 1995.
Oh, gotcha. Well,
yeah.
That's actually fairly recent. I mean, 95's been a while, but it's not that long ago. It's not like, you know, 85. Lots happened since then, but 95, that's... And the reason that I say this is because we're still dealing with a lot of the same problems that we were dealing with in 1995. So, well, there's a lot of government stuff that goes on in Colorado. There's strange facilities all over the place. Did you discuss any of your concerns with, I presume you did, with your friends and family and so forth, and maybe even coworkers you became friends with? What was their reaction to any trepidation you might have about going back there or having anything to do with working next to unsafely stored plutonium, where it's like, oh, you're just being paranoid? I mean, were they more concerned with kind of keeping a good job than worrying about the downside of it?
Well, it's interesting what you say about time, because Rocky Flats is, even today, a very, very controversial issue. in the state of Colorado, and it's an issue. Rocky Flats divides our community in so many ways, and some people believe that it was a necessary thing that we had to do, and they were proud of the work that they did out there. And other people, of course, once they became aware of what was going on, had quite a different feeling about it, and residents became increasingly concerned about contamination because there was extensive radioactive and toxic contamination on-site and off-site. And that's a concern that is true to the present day. I mean, plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, and there's a lot of it out there. It's going to be a problem for a long time. But so people had different ways of dealing with it. And I think, you know, when I was a kid and growing up as a young woman, we all, in our neighborhood and in my family, certainly, we all really believed and wanted to believe that the government and the private corporations that operated Rocky Flats, Dow Chemical, Rockwell, and later EG&G, that they would be truthful and transparent with us, and that they would tell us if they were putting our lives or our health at risk in any way. And that turned out not to be the case. That turned out not to be true.
So keeping the Russians at bay was worth the risk, I suppose. That suggestion comes from Mickey. I just thought I'd pass that along.
I think, you know, some people felt that way, certainly. And in the beginning, Rocky Flats was a secret because of the Cold War secrecy, and the plant was allowed to operate, you know, without really having to tell anybody exactly what was going on. And
sure,
the environmental laws like RCRA, 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 and the Clean Water Act, when they came into being, the plant was not required to follow those laws, and the Department of Energy fought environmental regulation very strongly. So in the beginning, it was due to Cold War secrecy, but then there were other reasons why the plant was kept secret, and I do think that part of it was due to the fact that it's in a beautiful part of the country. In the Metro Denver area, there's a lot of home building and development in the area, and a lot of business interest, and that makes it complicated too.
So they eventually stopped producing plutonium triggers.
Right.
Why did they stop doing this? I mean, did the pressure mount up to where they had to move them somewhere else? Or, I mean, I know obviously the government has to do things that cannot become general knowledge to the public. It's too bad that any collateral damage will be absorbed by the public. But, you know, there is an understanding that they just can't talk about everything. But they stopped making these triggers. Do you have an insight as to why this happened?
Well, what happened was that beginning in the late 1980s, when there was quite a bit of off-site contamination going on, including there was an incinerator that was burning radioactive waste, burning plutonium. There was extensive groundwater contamination, and all this stuff was getting into local neighborhoods. And residents were becoming concerned, and then there were workers at the plant as well. And some of this information was leaked to the press. And this led eventually to a very dramatic raid in 1989 on the part of the FBI and the EPA. And I believe it's the only time in the history of our country that two government agencies, the FBI and the EPA, have raided another agency, the Department of Energy.
You're using the word raid.
It was a raid. It was a raid. Around 45 FBI agents showed up at the gates, and the plant was, I believe it was 12 days, that they went through the entire plant. They went through the entire facility, and everything that they confiscated led to a grand jury investigation. And eventually the plant had to stop producing plutonium triggers. It started in 1989. They didn't completely stop until 1992. And as I said, Rocky Flats had produced 70,000 plutonium triggers.
Was that all?
And after the raid, that there was no other facility in the country that was producing plutonium triggers. The plutonium came from Hanford in Washington, and then the triggers, when they were ready, they were shipped to Pantex, to the Pantex facility in Texas, where they were encased in conventional explosives and actually became the bomb. But there was no other facility in the country that was producing the triggers like Rocky Flats. And after 1992, that was picked up by Los Alamos, by the lab at Los Alamos. And there, they have produced, it's still classified information, but somewhere between 2 and 10 triggers per year since that date. So a much slower rate of production and much more expensive. Rocky Flats, you know, Los Alamos is really the brains of our nuclear weapons program, and there were 13 facilities, connected facilities around the country that served in that program. But Rocky Flats was, we were the factory, we were the production line, we were the ones who put those things out at a high rate of speed. Production, you know, was always emphasized at Rocky Flats over safety. It was production over safety all the time.
Production over safety. I'm not a nuclear engineer nor physicist, but it doesn't sound like burning plutonium waste in an incinerator. That doesn't sound like a good idea to me, just on its face. Were there health consequences? Were there measurable negative health effects on people near the plant?
Well, yes, indeed. There were a lot of problems with workers, and of course, that's very well documented. And many of the workers have applied for compensation from the government. Only about a third of them have actually been compensated. But there were a lot of health effects in the local neighborhoods. And, of course, this area extends well into the Denver area. It's only about 11 miles from Denver, about 7 miles from Boulder, Colorado. And our house was about 2.5-3 miles from the plant itself. We saw a lot of health effects in animals, strontium in the bones of animals, a number of different things in cattle and deer and horses and that sort of thing. And then we saw health effects in the local population as well. Studies beginning in the late 1970s showed a higher rate of lung cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, testicular and ovarian cancers, higher rate of birth defects. And we saw that in a number of studies, as I said, beginning in the 1970s, right up to the present day.
I'll tell you what, when you speak those words, I just wonder, is the plant still open?
No. When I was working at Rocky Flats in 1995, and they started talking about closing it and trying to clean it up, they thought it would be impossible to clean it up and close it. They said that it would take decades and billions of dollars, and that the Department of Energy felt that it really didn't have the proper technology to clean it up anyway. There had been such extensive contamination. But eventually, they did do a cleanup, and it's kind of a compromise cleanup. It was done by a company called Kaiser Hill, and they did it in less than 10 years for $7 billion, less than a tenth of the original estimate.
$7 billion. To clean it up partially.
To clean it up partially. And it's a site that's roughly 6,000 acres. 1,300 acres of that site are so profoundly contaminated that they can never open to the public. They are permanently closed off forever. The rest of the site, roughly 4,000 acres, has very high levels of contamination. And they've kind of divided it into three different layers, but essentially there's no limit for anything below 6 feet out at that site, which, and I mention that because when I was working out at Rocky Flats, there were more than 800 buildings out there.
Yes.
Many of them were underground or partially underground. And plutonium and radioactive material was often moved between the buildings through underground tunnels and piping. So there's a lot of stuff that still remains out there underground. We're not exactly sure how much plutonium remains on site.
Understood. And we got to take a little break, Kristen. Tell you what, we've got about a half an hour to go. Let's take our break and come right back, all right? Her book is Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. She is Kristen Iverson, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, indeed. The empire's turned back to sand. I wonder what sort of technologies caused them to turn back into sand. Isn't it amazing what we're willing to sacrifice in the interest of... It's amazing how many people were willing to kill in order to avoid being killed by our enemies. Strange place, planet Earth, isn't it? When we come back with this hour's guest, Kristen Iverson, and her book, Full Body Burden, let's find out if Rocky Flats is still a controversial issue today and how it might even be a global issue, other than as to serve its purpose as a lesson, which I don't think is being learned. We're still producing. Oh, there's lots of talk about, let's get rid of these nuclear weapons. Seriously, who needs 70,000 plutonium triggers? I wonder how much of the Earth we could blow up if each one of those fire sets was affixed to a bomb. How about the whole thing several times over? Anyway, it hasn't gone away. And when you think about China and Russia getting buddy-buddy over primarily what's going on in Syria now, it does give one pause, doesn't it? We'll be back. Hang in there. This is Coast to Coast AM. Kristen Iverson, I was reading about Kristen Haig, the 11-year-old little girl that comes home with a bump on her knee that won't go away. And eventually she passes away. And then after her little funeral, her ashes are sent to be analyzed by three separate labs, one in New York, one in Richmond, California, and a primary contractor for Rockwell. The California lab reports a high level of plutonium-239 in Kristen's ashes, the type of plutonium used in nuclear bombs and routinely released by Rocky Flats. And the University of New York never performs the analysis. Her parents don't file a lawsuit. You know, it's staggering the amount of money it takes to sue the U.S. government. And eventually it just goes away. Her dad decides, well, it's in the hands of the Almighty and Rocky Flats has nothing to do with it. That's a pretty sad scenario, and I take it she was not the only one that was sickened to this degree and then eventually died from it.
Yeah, that's exactly right, sadly. I mean, there were a lot of sick kids and sick people in our neighborhood. In fact, I have to say, since this book came out, I've received hundreds of emails from people who live around Rocky Flats. And they're ill, and also people, from around the country who live around either former nuclear weapons sites or areas like Hanford, for example, the Savannah River site, or some of our aging nuclear power plants. You know, there are a lot of health issues around those places as well, and I think that this is one of the great untold stories right now. In this country, we're very, pro-nuclear power, and we're not really paying much attention to the long-term health effects of our nuclear weapons program. And these are people, I think, whose stories really need to be heard. I want to mention there was a study by Dr. John Cobb in the 1980s, and he looked at the bodies of 450 people who had lived around Rocky Flats in autopsies. He examined the lung and liver tissue, and he found plutonium in the lung and liver tissue. So there's no question that this stuff is getting into our bodies, and there's no question that there are health effects and cancers and all these other things. But the difficulty with lawsuits and that sort of thing is that it's very difficult to prove a direct link, and it's very difficult to work through the court system as far as these things are concerned.
Well, sure, it'll cost you everything you have just to mount a lawsuit against the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And it works the other way, too. If they accuse you of something, if this government accuses you of something, it'll cost you everything you have to defend yourself. So.
Well, and one of the problems is that the Price-Anderson Act is a law that protects companies that operate nuclear facilities and largely indemnifies them from any damage. And if that act was not in place, no one would go into the nuclear industry because it's so dangerous and risky. But what that means for people like us, for residents and people who live around these areas, is when something goes wrong, when there are health effects or lower property values or all the other problems, you know, that can happen, then we have to rely on the courts. And we haven't found much satisfaction or even acknowledgement in the courts as far as these things are concerned.
What is the name of that defense mechanism?
The Price-Anderson Act.
Price-Anderson Act.
Mm-hmm. Price-Anderson.
And to the best of your knowledge, how long is that protective bit of legislation, I suppose, how long has that been in place?
Well, it began, of course, with the Atomic Energy Act, you know, all the way back in the 1950s. And it was just recently extended, I think about a year ago, until 2032. I'm not exactly sure. It's 2030 or 2032.
2032.
The future, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the world should be in interesting condition by 2032. Hmm. All right. So, is there ongoing controversy about Rocky Flats, or has it been? It's not operational now. So, is it just business as usual? People haven't fled the scene in droves. They're still living there. Are these health problems still ongoing, and people continue to live there, or where are we with that?
Well, there are ongoing health problems, and there are a couple things that are going on. For one thing, the site, as I mentioned, has been closed, but there are 1,300 acres that are so profoundly contaminated they can never be open to the public ever. But the remaining 4,000 acres are slated to open as a national wildlife refuge. And as I mentioned earlier, very controversial levels of contamination remain. And it's slated to open for public hiking and biking, and possibly even hunting, school groups, you know, that sort of thing. So that's a problem, you know, and people who live near the area, there's no signage, there's no information available. People have no idea of what actually happened there and the legacy that remains. So in my own personal opinion, I think that that's a national wildlife refuge that should never open. And if people are going to go on site, at the very minimum, they need to be informed as to the kind of risk they may be taking. The other thing that's going on is that there's extensive home building going on in the area, and Parkway, Jefferson Parkway, is a highway that's slated to run right adjacent to the old site. It's all on contaminated land. And again, people don't know that land is contaminated. People who buy houses out there, buy these beautiful new houses, don't know that they're buying houses on contaminated land. And it's always been an area with a lot of transition, people moving in and out. And the story of Rocky Flats is one that really has been kept kind of under wraps, has still, you know, has been kept secret to the present day. So the issue is controversial, and it's going to be controversial. It's not anything that's going to go away. This is an issue that we have to face and talk about and let people know, you know, what's going on out there and why it's important that we remember the story of Rocky Flats.
You know, this chapter early in your book, the drums and bunnies. Tell us about the drums and bunnies so that I'd rather hear you talk about it than listen to myself talk about it. And then take us up to 1969 when little bits of plutonium begin to catch fire.
Hmm. Well, drums and bunnies, I like that chapter title. And one thing I should say is this is such a dark subject and a sad story, but it's also a family story and kind of a funny story. And I wanted to tell the story of many people who were involved in Rocky Flats. And I wanted this book to read like a novel. It's very heavily footnoted. Everything is fact-checked, but it reads like a novel. And I had some fun with some of the titles, the chapter titles. Drums and Bunnies. The drums refer to the fact that there were more than 5,000 55-gallon drums filled with plutonium-laced material that stood out in the open for 11 years. There was so much plutonium stored on site at Rocky Flats. They didn't know where to put it. They had trouble shipping it around the country. Nobody else wanted it. And even to the present day, we do not have adequate or safe storage for radioactive waste. It's a problem that's not going away. But these barrels stood out in the open for more than 11 years. And what happened with them? Well, the bottoms rusted out, and all of that radioactive and toxic material leached into the groundwater, was picked up in the soil, and picked up with the wind, and really spread throughout my neighborhood and over the Metro Denver area. So those are the drums. The bunnies, and that's part of the animals are a big part of the story, partly because, as I mentioned, we saw a lot of contamination in local animals. But in my family story, we always had animals and dogs and horses, and it was a big part of our family life. And I raised rabbits when I was a kid, and so that's part of the story. What we didn't know was that the rabbits out near Rocky Flats were radioactive. And one of the things that I uncovered during my research was some of the Department of Energy memos that talk about these radioactive rabbits as early as 1961. So they knew for a long time. And of course, the animals, to the present day, animals don't know that they should stay on site, that once they become radioactive, they shouldn't, you know, go off and into other areas. And of course, they do. There's plutonium uptake in the grass. The birds come along and nibble on the grass and fly off somewhere else. The deer move through. There are lots of groundhogs out there busily digging away and moving everything around. So it's still a dangerous area. But to take us up to the 1969 fire, that's quite a dramatic story. We had just moved into a new house, which was even closer to Rocky Flats. And it was May 11th, 1969. And my family, my two sisters and brother and I, we were out for Mother's Day with our parents. And we did not know that there was a fire at Rocky Flats, and the plutonium production facility was on fire. And it was a fire that burned through the glove box line, and glove boxes are the boxes in which workers actually form and shape and machine the plutonium triggers. They put their hands in lead-lined gloves and work with this material, and then there are these linked glove boxes, and this fire raced through the entire glove box line. And you can't use water on a plutonium fire without risking a criticality or a nuclear chain reaction. So it's very difficult to put out a plutonium fire.
This
fire got so hot that the roof of the building started to melt and rise like a marshmallow bubble, and it almost broke. We came within seconds of having a Chernobyl-like accident in the Metro Denver area.
Unbelievable. Hey, do you feel like taking a call? Because there are a couple of people that would like to talk to you.
Sure.
Let's talk to first-time caller Dorothy in Sholo, Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Come on the bridge. Hey, how are you doing tonight?
Fine. Thank you so much for having this wonderful guest on. I've been wondering for several years now that Rocky Flats area in which they want to open by the Fish and Wildlife for recreation, there was a citizens group that was trying to get access permission to take soil samples and establish how much plutonium was in the soil. Were they ever to get access to that and do that?
Yeah, thanks, Dorothy.
Yes, that's a great question. There has never been any off-site testing by the Department of Energy, and I think it's important for people to know that. There is a citizen group, an independent group, that hired an independent company to come in and do testing, and they did find plutonium off-site in two or three locations near the facility. One of those locations was in an open field, and another one was in the basement of a house in my neighborhood right down the street from my old house. So they found hot particles, of breathable particles of plutonium in at least two areas, and this was in late 2011.
Did the Fish and Wildlife claim that they did substantial testing, and did they have that open to the public, that data?
The Fish and Wildlife Service themselves have never done any testing. They rely solely on what the Department of Energy has done. and the Department of Energy says they can't deny that there is contamination, because there is contamination. And in Colorado, they allow 2 disintegrations per minute per gram of soil in areas around the plant, residential areas around that plant. But the Department of Energy will say that levels of contamination, as far as I know, are safe enough, and that is what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is relying upon.
Is that DOE information open to the public? Do you have to FOIA it, and can you have it, or is it classified?
There's a great deal of information that is available now, and some of it is on my website, and then I also have links to other websites that provide information.
Your website is kristeniverson.com, okay. Right?
Right. Iverson with an E.
Iverson with an E. Hey, Dorothy, thanks a lot. Let's talk to Brenda real quick. She's in San Francisco. Brenda, how are you?
Yes, John, thank you. I'm doing great. And it's ironic that this conversation is going on about plutonium, because I have just seen this evening with an elder friend here in the city, Aaron Brockovich, the film.
Yep.
About the PG&E contamination back in the 70s or 80s, I believe. But I wanted to make a comment, and that is, I had a niece who lived in Sitka, Alaska. She was born and raised there. In her early 20s, she moved to Colorado, which is Castle Rock, Colorado. And strangely enough, she started to become ill, and this was, quite soon after she moved there, and she lived there for 3 years. Within that 3 years, she had so many health problems, diabetes, her blood pressure, and she's very young to have all these physical problems. Her children became ill as well. She just recently moved back to Sitka, and her health has improved drastically. I'm just wondering if there's a correlation here with people's health.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for that. That is kind of a good question, Kristen. You know, we think of when you're exposed to radiation, it's immediately, cancer problems. But do you have any idea that it causes other health issues that might not necessarily point immediately to radiation-induced trouble?
Well, one thing that we see a great deal of in areas around Rocky Flats and residential areas are increased thyroid issues and a lot of immune deficiency issues, as in addition to cancer. And there's a high rate of brain tumor. I talk about this a bit in the book. And a friend and neighbor, Tamara Smith-Meza, is a young woman who's had 7 brain tumors, and their house was a little bit closer and directly downwind and right on the lake. They were drinking the water right up out of that groundwater table there. But we see a lot of that. And in my own family, we all have had immune deficiency disorders and that sort of thing. We've all got thyroid issues. And then one of my sisters has had several bouts with cancer. So can we tie this directly to Rocky Flats? You know, all I can say is that there is a preponderance of evidence there were a lot of sick people in my neighborhood when I was a kid. And I know I love Colorado. I no longer live in Colorado. I live in Memphis, Tennessee right now.
Gotcha.
And when I moved away, my health improved. Now, I was living I want to be careful and say I don't mean the entire state of Colorado is bad, but I think, and I love Colorado, but I think people who live in areas right around Rocky Flats should be aware of what happened and be aware of what remains in the soil, in the water, both on-site and off-site.
Okay. Hey, Kristen, I always push these breaks as late as possible. Can you just tell us very quickly, because we're down to like less than a minute, how is Rocky Flats a global issue?
Well, the accident at Fukushima, I think, reminded everyone all of us in a terrible way, that, you know, that this is something that affects all of us. So I'm talking about my backyard, literally, with Rocky Flats, but I'm really talking about everyone's backyard. And there are so many sites around the country, as I mentioned, Hanford, Savannah River, Pantex, so many.
Yeah, Hanford's leaking right now.
Hanford is leaking right now. And people really have to be aware of what they're being told, and they have to ask questions.
I hate to give you the rush, kiddo, but we got to go. Kristen Iverson, okay. Thank you so much for being on the program. KristenIverson.com, KristenIverseN. We'll be back in just a moment. Next up, Steve Starr on Coast to Coast AM.